World once again here on ABC Radio. As always, there's plenty to discuss with criminal law specialist Bill Potts and succession and elder law specialist Christine Smythe. They're both past presidents of the Queensland Law Society. G'day.
G'day.
Good morning.
And as always, if there's any issue or conundrum you'd like to put to them, or a topic worth discussing, you're welcome to join the conversation on 1300 222 612. But let's first of all get into some of the interesting legal issues in the spotlight this week. And I guess the number one was all about mask wearing in public and whether and the rights of various locations to enforce that health directive. What happens when you go to a big store in a state like, you know, Victoria, where mask wearing in public was the thing to do?
Well, there's two layers there that we're looking at. The first layer is the public health directive, which is a legislative direction, which makes it a criminal offence. And then there's the private layer about going into private property. And interestingly, I get this question quite a lot coming up with people who are attending funerals, and the question around, can I stop someone from coming to a funeral? And it all comes down to whether or not that person is on private property. If you are attempting to enter private property, then the owner and or occupier of that private property can set conditions of entry. It's just like going onto someone's garden or into their house. You can set conditions of entry. So places like big commercial operators, and given that I'm on the ABC, I won't endorse any of the particular commercial operators, they can set terms and conditions of entry. And more importantly, they have both a local and international duty under some treaties that Australia has signed up to ensure the health and safety of their workers. So if the health and safety of workers are being put at place, then the occupier, the business, can set terms and conditions of entry, and that includes wearing of masks.
Can they be ridiculous? Like, can they say you're not allowed to come in if you, unless you're wearing a yellow hat?
Well, when I was a uni student pulling beers in a pub, we used to have a rule: no shirt, no shoes, no service. It's a question of reasonableness and a question of whether or not, because there's a lot of this issue about my human rights and anti-discrimination laws. Anti-discrimination laws have evolved out of protecting innate qualities about a human being. What is innate about you? And they are things that are particular to you. But if they're not particular to you, then it is a question of whether or not they're applied universally.
There's a secondary point to that too, and that is the people who got to, for example, their hardware outlet, no doubt drove on the left-hand side of the road, no doubt had use of their blinkers when they were signalling to turn. So it's an odd thing that what they're doing, in fact, is choosing which laws they're going to obey. Now, we have laws for the general protection and safety of the greatest number. So it's just simply not a matter of saying, look, I'm a sovereign person, or my human rights are being impinged, or there's I think someone even quoted the United Nations Charter of Human Rights to justify this behaviour. The reality is that the laws are there to protect us, and you simply can't choose which laws you wish to obey or not.
And that includes when you are making a declaration about where you've been. Like, what are the laws that kind of surround these health and quarantine declarations that we make now?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. There are, I suppose, three elements of this. Firstly, there's a health directive. So the government health officer, under proper legislation, is able to say that people who have been in corona hotspots can't come into the state. So what happens is the secondary issue is that when people then come to the border, they have to sign a declaration. Now, a declaration is not just simply saying a few word formulas. It's actually swearing and declaring on penalty, effectively, of either fraud or swearing a false affidavit or a false declaration that something is true. And when people don't tell the truth in these documents, effectively, they're committing a fraud on the people of Queensland. We can see when that occurs, if it occurs, and of course these things have to be tested by courts, that there can be massive economic damage, there can be massive personal damage and delay. And these are things Putting aside, of course, the health issues, these are things which cost us all. So we have to make sure that the police, who are doing a great job but who have limited resources, simply are not being lied to.
And in terms of those $4,000 or $4,000-odd fines that are being slapped, you said could be tested in court. So do you have the choice of, you know, accepting that and paying the fine, or potentially trying to argue your case in court about that?
Well, of course, you can take the Clive Palmer option and take the government to court. And yes, every person has a presumption of innocence. So they can challenge that fine. They have the ability to go to court and put their case. Now it's a question of whether or not you want to spend $4,000 on a fine or $400,000 on a Supreme Court, High Court chase around constitutionality.
On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, Kate O'Toole is my name. And you're hearing from legal experts as we discuss some of the issues in the news this week. Bill Potts and Christine Smythe are here. And, of course, the big story in Queensland that's been in the news was the young women who travelled from Melbourne through Sydney and into Queensland and who are have been charged with fraud, lying to health officers and evading quarantine after that trip to Melbourne. Just curious, I mean, there have been lots of fines issued, lots of people who've been fined for, either attempting to come into Queensland after being to a hotspot or, not saying the right thing about where they'd been. Are you comfortable that we don't know the names and faces of all of those people who've been issued fines, but we do know the names and faces of these women who've been in the news today, this week?
You're quite right, Kate. There's been somewhere in the order of 2,261 people who have been fined for false declarations. There's been somewhere in the order of 2,600 people turned around at the border. So there's an awful lot of people behaving in an appalling way. But what we seem to be seeing is several people being picked out, and we're not just talking about these girls. There was another woman who was, a video was released where she had purportedly falsified her declaration. It's a question of how comfortable our community is around picking out some of these people for public shaming against other people who are not being picked out for public shaming.
Bill, do you agree or disagree? I mean, this is a point of contention where people have hold different views in this space.
It is. And, for example, if you or I were charged with criminal offences, there's simply no restriction on the press from reporting both our names and putting up pictures of us. And the whole idea there is the public interest. And the theory being is that if people are charged with breaking the law, well, of course, they can defend it. But the press quite rightly claim that the suppression of names or the suppression of photographs effectively is suppressing the public's right to know. And democracy, as we know, dies in darkness. So, yes, I accept Christine's point. That is that there is a lively debate to be had around it. But my personal view is that in these types of matters, provided they are adults, provided the press report accurately that they're alleged to have committed the offences, then I see no legal issue whatsoever with the effectively the production of their photographs and names.
On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, Kate O'Toole is my name. It's 21 to 11. We're talking about legal issues this week with two past presidents of the Queensland Law Society, Bill Potts and Christine Smythe. Now, another issue that's been in the news this week is about campaigning to raise the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14. What's your take on that, Bill?
Certainly. The Law Council of Australia last year received a detailed scientific report after a lengthy investigation. In Queensland, some of the listeners may be surprised to know that the age of criminal responsibility, that is when you can be charged with a criminal act and placed within effectively a jail, is the age of 10. And the science suggests that people's, or particularly children's, minds are not fully formed until a significant time later. Some might argue, somewhat wryly in the case of men, that the correct age of their brains maturing is 65. But the reality is that we see with kids that the scientific confluence of opinion seems to be that 14 is the age at which they can distinguish between right and wrong and exhibit sufficient power to, in fact, not commit offences. They can actually foresee the results. There are some 186 countries around the world that have the age of criminal responsibility for children set at 16. So Australia is very much an outlier internationally on this point.
I'm sure there are people listening now, though, who would say, my 10-year-old does understand right from wrong, or my 12-year-old does understand right from wrong. So what's the difference between understanding right from wrong in that way and also between that and then accepting full criminal responsibility for an act?
It's a question of your capacity to process it fully through to the conclusion and to foresee the outcome of what it is that you're doing. The law recognises this broadly. It recognises this with people who suffer from psychiatric conditions. It recognises it in particular with the aged population. We have a big problem with dementia in this country. We recognise that the brain can be affected in various ways, and that lack of capacity can and does impact your criminal responsibility. I struggle to balance how it is that we can see it at the other end of the scale when we're over 65, when we're not seeing it at this very, very young age.
But don't we, Christine, in some ways acknowledge that it's not full criminal responsibility because these 10-year-olds are not going to adult jail? There's an acknowledgement that the circumstances are different, that there would be some, you know, a juvenile offending place for them to go to if they are sentenced in that way.
There's a difference between the two arguments. Punishment, and that is where kids may be placed, is a different issue as to whether they in fact are criminally responsible. More often than not, when kids don't decide at the age of five that they're going to grow up to become criminals. The problems that cause criminality are often very complex, and they include poverty, mental illness, family violence, intergenerational issues relating to vulnerability. And the end effect of it is that what we as a society do is we recognise that it's not about punishment, particularly for very young kids. Often it's about protecting them, supporting them, connecting them if they can back with their society and if possible with their families. But just as the causes of crime are complex, so are the solutions. But we don't enliven jailing 10-year-olds because, quite frankly, they just don't have the capacity to foresee fully the effect of their crime. They might understand that hitting their little sister is wrong, but they may not understand that hitting their little sister may cause her to fall over subject herself to a significant brain injury. They just can't see that far because of effectively their age.
On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, you're hearing from Bill Potts and Christine Smythe, both former presidents of the Queensland Law Society, just having a general discussion about some of the legal issues in the spotlight this week. And an interesting question on the text. I wonder if you have a view on this. Obviously when governments make decisions around having to close for COVID reasons, people just have to follow it because it's in the public health interest. But if a business has to close because of someone not following the rules, can you see that, you know, business potentially suing individuals, for example?
Absolutely. If someone is breaking the law by falsifying a declaration, see, the object of the declaration is to identify whether or not they're being exposed to the virus. By identifying whether or not they're being exposed to the virus, they are then required to be placed in quarantine. By falsifying the declaration, they're giving themselves a free pass to circulate in the community. And by going into a business and causing that business loss, then if the business can show that specifically their business was shut down because that person was in their business and exposed them to risk, that business has the opportunity to sue them civilly for the loss that they sustain. The difficulty is, of course, it's one thing having a right, it's another thing having the capacity to enforce the right, but even if you get a judgment against these people, if they don't have the money to pay you, it's a Pyrrhic victory.
As in, you could potentially spend more money trying to chase money than you would get back if that person doesn't have a lot of money to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a balancing act. I'm completely sympathetic with these businesses. I'd be furious. I'd be angry. Their families, their livelihoods, their employees, even their landlords. It flows down the chain. The consequences are quite catastrophic, and they could either focus on trying to overcome the difficulty or focus on pursuing that person. Now, as it is, they do have a fairly lengthy period of time where they can pursue that person. If they can show the particular loss, then they can typically, the time period's around 6 years, depending on what the circumstances is, that they can sue that person civilly to recover the loss.
And just a quick call from, we're about to head into sport, but a quick call from Les. G'day, Les.
How are you?
Good. What was your question?
It's just about earlier this week they were talking about workers' compensation.
Uh-huh.
And my question, I was injured when I was 55 and, went through to retirement. Then when you get to retirement, they cut you off. But my question is about superannuation. When you're on workers' comp, like I missed out on 10 years of super, and I'm just wondering if that's all right or not. Like every other Australian gets superannuation.
Okay. When you talk about workers' compensation, what you're talking about is state legislation which mandates what compensation the state says that particular employer must pay you. And there's a two-tiered system. In Queensland, you can either pursue a civil process outside the workers' compensation system, or you can pursue the process within the workers' compensation system. And there's different rules and different laws around that. And so it's one of the things that you'd have to balance when you raise it with your legal advisor about that lost compensation. It's quite a valid point that you make, because you're losing 9% of your salary over the time of the work that you're out of work. It's a question of balancing the economic loss against the cost of pursuing it through the private system. And sometimes that balance puts you back into the workers' compensation system. And also it's faster and quicker within the workers' compensation system than it is through the civil system.
Ah, that idea of, is it worth pursuing? we return to that once again. Thank you so much for speaking with us today and discussing some of the legal issues of the week with us once again, Bill Potts and Christine Smythe.
Anytime. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, listeners.
On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, you've been hearing from criminal law specialist Bill Potts and succession and elder law specialist Christine Smythe, both past presidents of the Queensland Law Society. Next up,